Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Emma Donoghue, whose latest book is a collection of stories interrelated by theme called Astray. Earlier books include Room, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, Slammerkin, The Woman Who Gave Birth to Rabbits. Insofar as I could tell, there are 12 books in all. There's also four plays, several radio plays, a number of essays, and several short stories as well. I want to talk a little bit about Room, but let's start first with Astray. How do you find these strange little tales? Are you just sitting around looking at old newspapers?
No, I'm usually reading other people's books. You know, books breed other books, and I would say that I read social history quite a lot, and I go to museums and art galleries, and I listen to the radio, and I just sort of keep my eyes and ears open, and I come across these cases. I would say the only thing I do that's different is that I hook my nails into them immediately, and I go home and Google them. I never let one get away. I would say that's my only real talent here. But very often I'm drawing on the primary research of other scholars. I've done that kind of academic work myself, so I know how, in a way, quiet and thankless it is. So I'm deeply grateful to the scholars who do the kind of meticulous work in the archives.
Room, did that come about the same way and suddenly expanded? Or in the case of Room, did you always know that that was going to be a novel?
I usually have a fairly good sense of how long a story wants to be, or whether a story wants to become a play or a radio play. I usually try and listen to the material. In the case of Room, what I wanted was to be psychologically intimate with this child. I wanted to be in his head all the time and him to speak very, very freely to the reader. So I thought that the novel was the perfect form there.
So even before you put the first word down, you were pretty sure?
I'm a huge planner. If you see me in a cafe over my laptop, you might think I'm just staring into space, but I do a lot of thinking and planning and dreaming things up beforehand, yes. I'm not one of these writers who can write a well-structured book just, you know, by magic, as it were. I really have to put in the structure and the scaffolding first.
So by the time you actually sit down and do your writing, it's mostly already constructed.
Constructed, yes, which is not to say that the results are predictable, because you can easily find that things come apart in the writing and other things sort of spring up. So you go back and revise your plans, but to me it's essential to have those plans in the first place, yes.
For a book like Astray, each of these stories were published separately, and then they were collected here. In any of those stories, did you plan something, and when you sat down and wrote, what you wrote was completely different?
Not completely different, but often the human relationships start to alter a bit. The chemistry between any two characters is unpredictable until I actually write the dialogue. So it's not like just painting by numbers. You know, I may plan that two people will have a conversation, but once I start to actually write that conversation, the charge between them, and I don't mean necessarily an erotic charge, it could be anger, it could be anything, but that is unpredictable, and that will sometimes alter my plans.
Can you give an example from Astray?
You know, if I can't think of an example from Astray, but one of my previous novels, Slammerkin, I knew that I wanted the main character, a London teenage prostitute, to end up working in a house in the country. And I needed there to be other servants, just for realism, because there were always a few servants in a household. So I had to provide one male servant. And then as I was writing the book, I found the male servant was falling for this London girl, and I had not planned or predicted that at all. And so I rewrote it to allow for at least an ill-fated romance between them in the middle. So that my own characters do sometimes surprise me.
Well, when they surprise you like that, is it just like you write a sentence and you go, wait a second, like that?
Yes, it's almost like I'm listening in on them and I'm thinking, she's flirting or he's angry with her. Yeah, it is strange that way.
So you reread something and you suddenly see a direction that you didn't anticipate, basically.
Yes. And often what I would have planned are the basics. I'm thinking of one story from Astray, one of the earliest ones I published, and I've been really putting this book together over a decade and a half. One of the earliest ones is about an Irish couple, and I had read some of their letters to each other, because they were parted briefly during the 1840s when he went out ahead of her to Quebec, and then as soon as they raised the money, she and the kids were coming along after. So you might say I knew the basics, and I had seen their letters, but I didn't know the nitty-gritties of what I was going to invent for them to be thinking. You know, the story moves back and forward between them in their heads, and, you know, until you're actually doing it, you don't know what microcosmic little emotions are going to arise there. I think I was quite surprised by the details of how they would have felt alienated from each other by the distance, and the idea that each of them would in fact suspect that the other was getting on just fine without them, you know? Writing about a couple divided like that is a lovely kind of a test case for a marriage, you know? If you're not actually side by side sharing bed and board, then what is a marriage?
When you read these strange little tales and you start doing your research, at what point do you realize there's a story, or do you almost know there's a story from the beginning?
Well, I sort of sniff a story the moment I hear about the case. But I would say that happened to me about 40 times for the 14 stories in Astray. There are many potential stories, but often when I would do the research, I would find that really somebody else's account of this case was perfectly satisfactory. Not even necessarily fiction or play, but sometimes a historian has done a really good account of something. So I only start writing a short story about these cases if I feel that there's something only fiction can bring to this, that there's some new angle or missing side or unusual point of view on it. For instance, Jumbo the Elephant, he's actually fairly famous. There have been a few books about him, and they often feature as an important personage Matthew Scott, Jumbo's keeper. But I suppose my idea was to write a whole short story in the voice of Matthew Scott directly speaking to Jumbo, which would capture the astonishing intimacy between these people. I mean, Matthew Scott used to spend his evenings sitting around in Jumbo's stall drinking whiskey with him. You know, I mean, they had this amazing kind of cross-species love.
Emma Donoghue, when you're looking at those stories, and as you're sitting there with your cup of coffee or watching Dora the Explorer and planning them, how easy or hard is it to find the right voice, the right way it is? For instance, there's a story, The Gift, which is an epistolatory story. It's written in letters. So, for instance, in that story, how did the letters idea come? Do you remember?
Yes, the whole source for that story was that I was interested in the orphan train movement, where a lot of kids from the cities of the East Coast were sort of shipped off west to what were assumed to be more sort of wholesome situations, fresh air and foster parents. And some of them went back afterwards and some didn't. So I wanted to pick one. And on a website about the orphan train movement, I found literally just a list of letters received by the New York Children's Aid Society, with just minimal notes from their ledgers, more or less saying, the mother wrote, wants to know, can she see the child? The adoptive father wrote. But that's all we had. We don't have the actual letters. We just have the notes on the letters. And also, I think the reason I was immediately drawn to that as a way of writing the story is that I like to make it morally complicated. So to write a story in the point of view of the mother who lost her child to the sinister bureaucrats, that would be far too easy. But I thought if I wrote it in alternating letters between the birth mother and the adoptive family, then we, the readers, are going to feel tugged both ways because, you know, on both sides, I'm slightly making fun of them. The birth mother as a bit of a, you know, poor life skill, shall we say, and she keeps changing husbands. But then the adoptive father is a bit stiff and fusty. So, you know, I'm not 100% sympathetic to either, but both of them have a strong claim to be the child's parents. And so I want the reader to feel completely tugged. Same thing with one story I wanted to write about rape during the American Revolution. On the British side, they used rape as an actual war crime. They would do it as a matter of policy to reduce morale among rebel sympathizers. So I wanted to write about that issue, but not in an abstract way at all. And I thought, again, if you tell it from the point of view of a victim, it's just far too simple. So I thought, you know, let's mix up and confuse the reader's sympathies again. So I decided to write it from the point of view of one of the soldiers, but he's a 15-year-old German mercenary who was sent out there with no clue about what's going on. He's not even being paid. He's pretty much an indentured servant. So again, our sympathies are horribly divided. So I really want people to finish these stories feeling far more mixed up than when they began.
The point of the stories is to create confusion, not solve it.
And to create massive empathy on both sides so that, yes, we're horrified by something like an episode of mass rape, but we're horrified about all angles on it. And so we think differently when we read about, you know, rape camps in civil wars today as well and child soldiers. So it's not even hard to draw links between historical material and contemporary material. I mean, to me, the echoes are obvious.
Well, that seems to be running through all of your stories is that there's a contemporary pull. I mean, obviously, all historical fiction is on some level contemporary. So there is that pull, but you're not necessarily looking for that pull when you're writing your stories.
No, I certainly don't. You know, people sometimes say, why would you choose to set a novel in the 18th century? You know, is it some elaborate kind of trick for commenting on modern events? But no, that would be to use history rather cheaply, I think. I mean, to me, these people matter just as much as we do today. But of course, I'm bringing my own set of interests and preoccupations to this material. So, of course, you know, things are going to arise which matter today. And also, I write a lot about the 18th century and the 19th century and, you know, the big ideas of today, like about civil rights, human rights, gender, race. I mean, they've all been discussed passionately since the 18th century. So in a way, it's a discussion, it's a cultural discussion that's been going on since the 18th century.
When you're writing them, is it sometimes hard to keep the modern ideas out of them, to kind of like try to write without letting your point of view take effect? Or how does that work for you?
I don't think you can write it neutrally. If I choose to write about something that has strong echoes of today, it's not like I have to put modern language onto it. I mean, the issues are right there in the older sources as well.
But at the same time, the point of view is yours. And I can see certain cases in this book where current political life, for instance, the story of the lesbian sculptors, where current political life suddenly is going to impinge on the story itself. And how do you play that?
You know, it's funny. For me, it's come up more when dealing with actual parliamentary politics, like my novel from 2004 called Life Mask. It was about politicians fighting a very right-wing government in Britain during the French Revolution. And, you know, the echoes of the Bush administration were just deafening to me. So in a way, when I'm dealing with matters like that, it's much harder to keep the modern perspective from intruding. When I'm dealing with matters of sexuality, I find I'm very comfortable working within the terms of the day. So the story you mentioned is set in the 1960s. When, you know, the kind of relationship that these two women sculptors had existed in a kind of a social twilight of, oh, yes, they spent their lives together and very few people asked too much. I mean, once in a while somebody might, you know, throw a word like lesbian at them, but it wasn't generally very labeled, whereas 20 years later it would have been very labeled. So I'm really very comfortable working with, you know, whatever the terms are that were used in each era to describe sexuality. And I really like the lack of labeling, if you go back far enough, actually. I like those complexities, you know, that people were not neatly categorized.
Emma Donoghue, in creating this book in particular, were you just looking for books about emigrants and people on the outside, or did the stories emerge knowing full well that down the road you might be able to put them together?
I think when I'd published one or two of them, I realized that, in fact, I wanted to do a whole collection on the theme of not just travel in general, but, you know, life-changing journeys. I was moving to Canada towards the end of the 90s anyway. That's where I live now. And I was getting more interested in stories either set in Canada or America or about people journeying to or within North America. So it seemed a fairly natural move. Very early on, I realized that by calling it Astray, I was going to be looking at cases where people weren't just crossing geographical borders, but also, you know, breaking rules and an interracial relationship in the days when it was forbidden, breaking of the law, for instance, a couple of cross-dressers in there, and people going astray in their wits, as we say in Ireland. So it seemed to happen quite naturally that the metaphorical meanings of going astray came up a lot, because I think when people make enormous journeys, they're losing their moral context. And so either they can allow themselves to do things that were forbidden back home, or they can find themselves, you know, morally adrift in the new context. So I was very interested in the different ways lives change when you make one of those irrevocable journeys.
Well, there's one story that reminded me a little bit of Brokeback Mountain, which is the story that takes place in the Yukon, where these two men are alone with each other, and a lot of men had to have been alone with each other. How much research did you do for that story?
That one quite a bit, though I drew mostly on one particular 1950s history called Klondike by the Canadian historian Pierre Burton. In that case, it was the situation I got from history. I didn't have the individual's names. In that book, Klondike, what he said was that typically these gold miners had to pair up and they called each other partner. That was the word. You know, two partners would go in together as a joint venture and would spend the entire winter literally burning the ground and scraping dust out of it. And then in the spring, you would see what had come of it. And I thought, you know, from everything we know about men in prisons and in other single sex situations, you know that some sex is going to happen in some of the cases, at least. And I thought it would be very interesting to look at a pair of these partners and see what might happen if one of them took it more seriously than the other. You know, I also liked the idea of this happening, of the sex happening in a context of complete physical horror, and that they've got scurvy, you know, they're freezing, they're almost dying, they're afraid they'll end up boiling their shoe leather. So in a situation like that, you know, I think the normal rules about what to do with your body would just fall by the wayside.
Well, they're also stuck in a freezing situation where they need each other to stay alive for the body heat.
Exactly. And also there's nobody else around. And in a way, that's the issue I was looking at in Room, was what happens when you make up a little society of two, you know, and you just forget those outside rules because there's nobody watching, you know?
Well, in Room, it means that you have a five-year-old who's still getting breastfed.
Indeed, indeed. Whereas the mother in that book wouldn't have chosen to do that if they were living outside of Room, but in that context, it made sense. She gave the child what he needed in that setting.
I kept thinking, why didn't she ask old Nick for formula?
There would have been one more thing to ask for, and if breastfeeding is happening successfully, you know, you don't mess with it. I think that the real question is why she didn't wean him, but in a way they were still in this little mother-baby unit with nobody else around. I mean, my own sense of it is that you wean your baby at the point where, well, in my case, I wanted to go on a book tour. How was that for a shallow reason? So my 16-month-old, I weaned her at that point. So, you know, you wean your baby when there's a good reason for it, like you want to go out for more than a single evening. So, in Room, I would say that the mother and child were living in a very kind of mother and newborn dynamic.
A lot of these stories in Astray take place over expanses, and yet there's also a sense in many of the stories, not merely the Klondike story, but also Last Supper at Brown's, which takes place in a house.
It's a kitchen, really.
Just a kitchen, really. There's a certain claustrophobia, and of course, claustrophobia is the nature of the first third of Room. What do you think is going on with you there?
It's interesting. Yeah, I don't think of myself as claustrophobic, but you know, I live a life that I would never write about in fiction, you know, because I live an extremely happy life, whereas fiction, you want people to be in situations of difficulty. So confining them, making them feel trapped and longing for escape and longing to go somewhere else, that's just an excellent setup for fiction. You want people to have secrets, you want people to have fundamental conflicts with each other, irreconcilable desires. So that's just the nature of fiction, I think.
And all of these people, while they're the stories, they feel confined and claustrophobic, the entire point of the stories is escaping from the claustrophobia.
They want to, but I suppose there is that paradox that, for instance, the Irish woman on the ship to Quebec, you know, a ship is going somewhere, but as long as you're on the ship, you're trapped. And, you know, there were weevils in the biscuit and maggots in the ham. And so it's like being in a sort of a, you know, locked prison camp as long as you're on the ship. So there are many paradoxes to travel, especially back then. I mean, travel nowadays is a doddle by comparison. But if you write historical fiction about travel, you know, the stakes are wonderfully raised because people were going so much into the unknown. I mean, so many emigrants who came out to America or Canada, they were looking at government propaganda that said it was going to be fields of gold, you know. They really didn't know what they were getting into, and there were so many unknowns, and, you know, their family might have all have died by the time they managed to contact them again.
I remember asking Antonia Fraser years ago what it was like, the worst part about living in the time of Henry VIII, and she said, dental. Dental problems. Everybody had black teeth, and they were always in pain.
That's true. And, you know, when I was a child, I had asthma, not very seriously, but still I had asthma and used an inhaler. And I remember thinking, you know, if I was some 18th century lady, I'd be sitting wheezing by the fire and probably get a bit weaker every winter and then wouldn't make it, you know. And, of course, I would have died in childbirth, as so many of my friends would have, you know, without a bit of 20th century medical care.
And, of course, you know, unless you were really able to do it, you'd have wound up getting married to a guy and living that kind of life and not being happy.
It's true. It's true, though. I would probably have managed one way or another.
Well, you did become a writer, and being a successful writer is not easy.
Oh, it's so much a matter of luck. You know, I'm so aware of that. I've met so many people who write brilliant books that just don't quite sell in big enough numbers, and then they find it so hard to get the time to write another one. And it's such a fluke whether you hit the big time or not.
You're listening to an interview with Emma Donoghue, whose latest book is Astray. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Emma Donoghue, with Room being shortlisted for the Man Booker, with Alan Hollinghurst winning the Man Booker, do you think the gay literary ghetto is finally disappearing?
Interestingly, I've heard some people claim that it's disappearing more in Britain than in America, at least for women, where I would say writers like Sarah Waters and Ali Smith, Jeanette Winterson, they're really taken seriously as stylists. Jackie Kay would be another. I'm sometimes claimed as a Brit along with them, even though I'm actually Irish. So I've heard it said that, you know, lesbian authors have a bit more trouble getting into the mainstream in the States, whereas in both the States and Britain, there's a strong tradition of gay male authors achieving a lot of success, like, say, Michael Cunningham, as well as, say, Alan Hollinghurst. I think things are certainly a lot better than they used to be. And certainly, this is a different question, but I would say personally, I choose to worry about this as little as possible.
Well, I think also that a book like Room, which doesn't have any of that that content within it, you have to be treated as simply a writer.
Oh, I think you are. I think that the prejudice actually is not against the writers, it's against the content. So the real question is why straight readers often don't let themselves pick up or buy a book with a same-sex storyline. So I think their fear is not that the writer is somehow unclean, but that the book itself won't appeal to them. And I think you get a similar thing about race in literature. I think when somebody is famous enough, like Toni Morrison, everybody will pick up their books. But I think in other cases, you know, I think there are white readers who will pick up a book and say, oh, that sounds like a good book for African Americans, and they put it down and walk away, you know. So I fear that that kind of ghetto is operating around matters of sexuality and race and various other isms. I think the more we can do to lure readers across those boundary lines, the better for them.
Do you think those boundary lines exist in theater? You've written a lot of plays.
I suspect they do, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, there are so many situations in which you would read a one-line summary of a play and you'd say, oh, is that for me? You know, and it's hard to even tell what's going through your mind at the point where you decide to try to go see that and not go to see it. Same with film. I think we all tend to stick to what we know or something that's maybe pleasingly exotic, but we still have a strong sense of sort of what's for me and what's not for me. I know one of my deep down prejudices is that almost all the books I buy are written in English. Even though I know translators can produce something that's just as good, I just, when I pick up a foreign novel, I think very often something in me says, not quite for me.
I found in picking up Room, for example, that at the very first page, I was put off by the voice of a five-year-old.
Because, oh, many are.
Because before you get into the story and you know the details, you have to deal with a voice which is alien.
Indeed, and actually there are some books that have a much harder voice. I'm thinking of, say, some of the fiction of a Scottish writer like Irving Welsh or James Kelman. It's almost impenetrable at first. Or books written in a kind of a futuristic pigeon, like part of Cloud Atlas, say, A Clockwork Orange. So there are books that you almost have to force yourself on the first 10 or 20 pages, yeah. And, of course, the voice of a child can be very off-putting, because if you don't have a five-year-old in your life, or even if you do, frankly, they can be really annoying. So my mother said to me, she said, your father will only read this book because he loves you, Emma. He wouldn't read it otherwise.
How focused were you on those first 20 pages, knowing that eventually the story will take hold? How focused were you on trying to ensure that I would keep reading, let's say?
This brings me to the question of whether or not you imagine the reader as you're writing. I would say that I imagine the reader, but I assume a reader who is very motivated to read my book. So I don't let myself think, will they be bored rigid? Will they be completely repelled? I sort of assume that I've got some kind of contract with the reader. This reader wants to read my book. And so I think of things like, okay, will they be completely confused by that reference on page 3? How long will they hold that particular fact in their mind before I explain it to them? So I think about the reader in those technical terms of, you know, how long they will remember things and how soon they will connect the dots. But I don't tend to let myself worry about whether or not the reader will be completely put off. I figure if I believe in the story, that they will, you know, that they will too. And they may or may not, but it would be very off-putting to me to say to myself, oh, they won't care about this at all.
To that degree, I guess there's no difference between writing a short story or a novel that way.
No, you could say with a short story that you have to thrill the reader a bit faster, because with a novel, people relax into it a bit and they might say, okay, I'll give this 20 pages. Whereas if they know it's a short story they're reading, you know, they probably won't give you 3 pages. So I think with a short story, there's a very helpful pressure actually to get moving fast. And I don't even necessarily mean get moving in action terms, but provide something the reader is going to care about pretty quickly.
Is it easier or harder to create an ending for a short story or a novel or even a play?
Oh, it all depends on the story. You know, some plots are just stronger than others. You know, my own preference is to end things fairly early before you spell everything out. And this sometimes irritates my readers. I mean, people write to me every day begging me for more about Room. You know, tell us how Jack did at school. Tell us how Ma found a boyfriend. You know, what was their life 10 years on? Whereas to me, you know, it was very, very important to cut it off. The minute they visited and said goodbye to the room, that was it. But I know people do sometimes complain that my endings are a bit quick and tantalising. But I just love the idea that the story lives on in the reader's mind and the reader will fill in some more possibilities.
Well, I was wondering, as I was reading Room, how you were going to finally end it. But when you did end it, that was clearly the ending. It had to end with them going back and walking out. And finally, on a metaphorical level, that's it. That's it for them. They can move on.
Yeah, and that would be an example of where I usually know the ending before I start the book. You know, I have a clear shape, a sense of its shape in my mind. And in Room, for instance, I knew the escape had to be halfway through. You know, I wanted it to have the shape of like a, you know, two halves of an apple or something. I wanted it to feel very pleasingly clear in its shape.
In Room, and we're not giving that much away because it's pretty obvious what's going on, without going into too much detail, there are these two halves of the book. You've got these characters who have spent the last, she's spent, what, 8 years?
7 years.
In the room, and he's spent his whole life there, and he's five. And then the second half, they're in the real world. Which side was harder to write?
The second half needed a bit more thinking, I suppose. The first half, it was such a lovely kind of casebook example of a character as sort of tabula rasa, you know, in that I was able to show who this boy was based on all the raw ingredients that were there, his own sort of nature, but also basically everything his mother had taught him, all the events that had ever happened to him. I knew his whole little world. So in some ways, it was way easier to write than to write, you know, a character roaming around a city today. Whereas the second half, I had to think carefully about sort of which particular aspects of the world he would encounter. You know, I didn't want it to be like some high-speed tour around the world in 80 days. So I had to, while making it seem very sort of ordinary and domestic, you know, Jack goes to the mall with his grandmother, I had to actually carefully plan which encounters he would have with the world. But it was all very easy, actually. Room is the easiest book I've written because it has the strongest sort of central idea. That meant that the narrative tension was always there. I always knew we were heading towards the final moment when he would, you know, revisit the room and say goodbye to it.
There's also quite a bit of satire in the second half. Did you have to kind of keep a lid on it in a way, make sure it didn't get carried away?
No, it's funny. I know some critics thought that I was sticking in too many of my own opinions, but it's more that once I had created this character, this sort of innocent child who's not used to our world, it just seemed to me very natural that he would be critical of many aspects of contemporary life. And, you know, far from it being my way of attacking my enemies, it's more like that the thing Jack is most critical about in the second half of the book is parenting like mine. You know, he sees mothers in Starbucks basically bribe their kids with giant lollipops so that they can check their email. You know, I'm that mother. I'm not the devoted one locked up in the room with him. I'm the multitasking one. His opinions seem to come very naturally out of his character. That's all I can say.
Emma Donoghue, you've said that you're kind of shocked that people call it a thriller, but it is.
Oh, I'm delighted people call it a thriller. And actually, you know, what I'm trying to write right now is my first crime novel. And I think it's because with Room I got that slight taste for keeping readers in suspense. I mean, it's so exciting to me that people write to me and say they're halfway through the escape scene in Room and they can't bear to turn off the light, you know. Yes, I'm now actually trying a crime novel for the first time ever. And of course, you know, I'm afraid I'll get it all wrong and embarrass myself, but it's always worth pushing yourself to try a new genre. You don't want to get stuck in your ways.
The way to push a story forward is to know when to end a chapter, when to switch gears, when to put in. It's a very different kind of effect than just writing a straightforward mainstream novel.
It's true, but even straightforward literary fiction, in a way, you still, in a more quiet way, you still want the reader to have questions and puzzles and worries and tensions, and you have to know when to relieve these and when to apparently relieve them, but then trick the reader into feeling anxiety again. So the issues are not that different, really.
And in a short story, are you focused on that at all, or is that is the motivating factor different? Is the drive different?
No, I see short stories as like novels in miniature, really. I don't subscribe to the school of thought that says, you know, short story is just a little fragment. it can just go on for X pages and then stop. I mean, the short stories I like best are ones like Alice Munro's that are really a life packed into 10 pages, you know. So I think often short stories follow exactly the same rules of plot. And a couple of the stories in Astray, I tried to construct them like sort of puzzle stories. Say there's one about a young widow who announces her husband is dead, and you know, I wrote that whole story like a sort of miniature mystery.
There are actually two stories that have that thriller aspect. There's that, and there's the story about stealing Lincoln's body.
Oh yes, there was, I enjoy that one so much because these particular criminals, they, you know, so grandiose and ludicrous. They wanted to get their best counterfeiter out of jail by digging up Lincoln's body and offering to swap them. You know, such a bizarre plan.
And this is true.
It is, it is. It's all true. They were foiled at the last minute. And so I decided to write that story from the point of view of the Secret Service informant who was undercover among them. You know, I've never done that kind of classic sort of crime caper about quarrels between criminals, and I just thought this was an irresistible one.
Emma Donoghue, on your website, in the Frequently Asked Questions, you make a comment: all writing is political. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that often it's only writers from some kind of minority group who get asked about, you know, how political their writing is. Whereas if rich white people write about rich white people, or if men write always about men, often they're not asked, why don't you include the minorities? Whereas if you write a book that's focused on, you know, race or sexuality or gender even, it's often assumed that you have an axe to grind. Whereas really what I feel is not any obligation to grind an axe, but I like my fiction to be diverse. So in a book like Astray, I really like alternating the points of view of men and women and the rich and the poor, and, you know, just getting a sense of that mixture of populations that has come to America and Canada and made them the, you know, wonderful mixed up places they are today.
If you're removing the answer from the question and just saying all writing is political, do you think that's true?
I do. I don't mean that all writing has a clear political agenda, because, you know, if we wanted to write a campaign, we would. It would be a lot simpler. But I think you're making decisions as soon as you choose to write a short story about somebody. You know, even a two-page short story, you're already making decisions, not just about how to represent them, but about whose point of view to give at all. It's very aware that historical fiction, like the kind I write, is mostly a matter of giving voices back to those who've been forgotten, you know, losers often, or giving a new angle on things, something that hasn't been said before, revisiting older issues. Both that and my contemporary fiction, I'm just very aware that the kind of choices you make always have a politics behind them.
What do you think draws you to people who are unrepresented?
You know, I grew up on stories of royalty. You know, I used to read historical novels about people like Henry VIII all the time, you know. And there's still a thrill to that. I mean, you know, I'm immersed in the second of Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell novels at the moment. It's absolutely fascinating. But to me, it's even more exciting to come across a case of somebody who's completely dropped out of the historical record, or somebody who mattered once and has since been forgotten about. You just have more of a sense of the power of fiction if you manage to bring someone like that to life in your writing.
Is that why, from a nonfiction point of view, you focus on lesbian literary fiction, which has also been forgotten and disappeared?
It's true. And in fact, often it hasn't just sort of naturally dropped out of circulation, but in that case, a lot of, shall we say, that the regular occurrence of the lesbian theme in English literature has often been argued away. That's, you know, critics will take a book like, say, Henry James's The Bostonians, which is a really pretty crystal clear love triangle where a man and a woman are fighting over a girl, and they will, you know, describe it as anything but. They'll say, oh, it's all about, you know, feminism in the 19th century. It's all about class. It's all about the North versus the South, you know. So often they'll go to great lengths to erase that theme. Yeah, so it's wearing my hat as lesbian historian, I'm quite interested in sort of digging up things that have been forgotten. Yeah, but I would say when I'm writing fiction, my interests are much broader, really. And I do sometimes write about the rich. I'm just mostly drawn to, I don't know, finding a novel angle on things rather than creating a narrative which seems familiar.
What is Pluck?
Pluck is a short story I wrote about a man who gets obsessed with a hair on his girlfriend's chin, a single hair. You might say that's not a big deal, but this particular man, you know, he's trying to be very cool with his girlfriend and the fact that she has a hair on her chin. He's trying not to let it bother him, but it does bother him. And this was caused by my own experience of once having a girlfriend who had a hair on her chin. And again, I didn't want to demand that she remove it, but it did bother me. So anyway, the man in my story gets obsessed and starts trying to secretly remove it while she's asleep and so forth. And this is the only one of my works that's been filmed yet. It's a 10-minute film, and it's hilarious to see, you know, his mind start to completely crack up under the influence of this, you know, minor obsession.
In 2003, you wrote several radio plays. What's the story of that?
Oh, I've been writing radio plays quite a lot over the years. I've often written them as, you know, a week-long series of short ones. Radio drama is really strong in England, so I've written a lot for Radio 4. So the last one I did for BBC Radio 3 was about a girl with a rare condition called androgen insensitivity syndrome, which is where you look completely female, but, you know, then when you're in your teens, you don't get your periods, and then the doctors discover that you are genetically male. Like with the situation in Room, you might say, why would you take such a rare premise that only happens to one person in a billion? And I suppose I feel that these really, really rare cases can illustrate something about everyday life for the rest of us. So just as in Room, I felt the situation of a woman locked in a room raising her child, you know, it managed to capture feelings that almost all of us have had at one moment or another. You know, that feeling of being stuck with your child. I suppose similarly, a test case like somebody with that intersex syndrome can make all of us think about, you know, how arbitrary the rules of being male and female are.
The other side of that is Daddy's Girl or M. Butterfly even.
Yes, yes. Daddy's Girl's story in Astray is about Murray Hall, a New York politician who was discovered on his death to have been female. The obvious thing would have been to write a story in which Murray Hall tells all and explains her decision, but I thought it would be far more interesting to tell it from the point of view of her adoptive daughter, who suddenly finds herself, you know, orphaned at 18 and no idea where she came from or where her parents got her or how.
And there's no Rosebud to give an answer either.
No, there isn't. What really seized me about that source was that all we know is that the girl wouldn't talk to reporters, and also that she refused to say she when referring to her father. She stuck to he. So that gave me the idea of a young woman who must have been extraordinarily angry with this dead father and tantalized by the lack of knowledge, and yet still somehow loyal, wouldn't say she.
Emma Donoghue, what's the story on filming of Room? Anything?
Nothing I can declare yet. I wrote a screenplay myself even before the book was published. And I'm very keen for a film of it to be made, and I'm talking to filmmakers, that's all I can say. So hopefully I'll have news.
And you've started work on another novel, which you say is kind of a crime novel. That's the one set in San Francisco in the 1870s?
That's right, yes. There's a particular murder that happened on the south side of San Francisco.
Real one?
Yes, an unsolved murder where a young woman was shot through a window. I've been preoccupied with this case for at least 10 years. The sources are mostly newspaper accounts of the inquest, and they're all, you know, clashing and inconsistent, and it's a kind of muddy, messy source that's just perfect for fiction.
Well, you're here in the Bay Area as I'm talking to you. What kind of research do you do here, or don't you feel that going to the location will help you?
You know, going to the location is very helpful for a sense of landscape. So I'd say on my trips to the Bay Area, driving around a bit, looking at the landscape is helpful. But of course, the actual architecture is all different. For instance, my story is set in Chinatown, but Chinatown in the 1870s didn't have any of the Chinese-looking fancy gilt stuff that you see now. That was all put in later. So Chinatown in those days would have been much more dark, shabby, and oppressive. So really, the real way I can visit San Francisco of the 1870s is by reading endless newspaper accounts. You know, it's kind of blinding work. You're looking at these scanned newspapers on websites, and you're peering at the screen trying to figure out what that particular word is and which bit they've misspelled. Because often, as they've been scanned in, the computers misread the words, so the sources are very messy. You can't really go there otherwise. You know, looking at how a place is today can actually be a bit misleading. My main character, Jeanne Bonnet, the one who got shot through the window, she was a frog catcher. So somebody interviewing me the other day said, Emma, there's something on Wikipedia saying you're writing about a frog catcher. That's surely a hoax. And I said, no, she was a frog catcher. She supplied frogs to the French restaurants of San Francisco. But she was catching her frogs in San Mateo, you know. It's hard to imagine a totally different kind of rural landscape now just outside the city.
When you're writing these stories in Astray or this new novel, how much do you worry about the accuracy of how they speak, or even the accuracy of the content?
In some ways, I care a great deal about it. Like, I've been, you know, fiddling over exactly what happened on each day in terms of the murder. But very often when you find that the sources are clashing with each other, you have to make your own judgment in the end. And I will deliberately change some things to shape a story better, but I always sort of keep notes on what I've changed. I think that's allowable to make a better story. But I'll read a lot about things like what species were around at the time. For instance, you know, the frogs she was catching, they weren't the big fat bullfrogs, they were the Californian red-legged frogs. So I do a huge amount of research at that sort of microcosmic level. But if something needs changing to make the story move better or move faster, in historical fiction we very often telescope events because real life is slow and messy. So I care quite a lot, but I mean, ultimately it is fiction in the end. I suppose I care enough to make a note on what I've changed, but it's not that I don't let myself change anything.
What I've heard said is that it doesn't matter if it's true or not, as long as it feels true.
There's that too. And you mentioned dialogue. That's a good example. If you use the actual speech of the time, it can actually create a bit of a veil or a barrier between the reader and the text, because, you know, the reader feels that what they're getting is like a pastiche of Mark Twain or something. So very often with historical fiction, I go for a language which is kind of halfway between then and now. And I don't mean that it would be a language of the 1930s. It's almost like you go for a language that's grammatically quite similar to what we speak now, but you put in words from the 1870s. So you sprinkle them in for flavor, but you don't really use the grammatical structures of the 1870s, because if you did, it would be quite alienating for the reader. So you find a careful kind of midpoint.
Is that what you do for your plays as well?
Yeah, I would say the same thing. What you're trying to give people is the impression, not just that they're listening to 1870s dialogue, but that they are right there, as comfortable with 1870s dialogue as people living in the 1870s would have been. So you want that sense of ease and familiarity. So you can sometimes get that by going for something a bit more modern than the period you're writing about, because you want the reader to feel, you know, sort of intimate with that time.
We just had an election. How do you look at that, the American election that just occurred?
Oh, I would say everyone I know in Canada was walking around with grins of relief, you know, because, you know, even though we have our own system up there, we are very culturally influenced by you down in the States. So the thought of a Romney America was giving us all the heebie-jeebies.
And finally, Emma Donoghue, how far into your book about San Francisco are you? Have you actually sat down and started writing?
Oh, yeah, I'm writing it. I'm in the middle of drafting it, I would say, yeah.
And how many drafts do you usually go through?
I usually do one rough one for myself, and then I show it to my agent, and she, you know, gives me a lot of feedback, and so I produce at least a second one before I'd show it to any publisher. So I would say all my books have at least three drafts and sometimes more.
You have any short stories coming out?
Not any more collections, but the occasional one or two, yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Emma Donoghue, whose latest book is Astray, collection of short stories, and her novel Room is just out in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.